Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Lane Smith is a transmasculine non-binary writer with over 20 years of experience as an activist, organizer, and tarot reader. They have been involved in struggles against war, the death penalty, attacks on LGBT rights, and body autonomy for marginalized genders and birthing people, police violence, and apartheid. They have worked as a social worker in prisons and in the field of harm reduction with people who are at risk for HIV/AIDS. With a professional master's degree in social work and an academic master's degree in humanities and social thought, Lane expresses their ideas in clear, non-academic language in the interest of putting social justice values into practice. Lane is the editor of the Tarot and Politics zine and a member of Solidarity Tarot, where they live in Baltimore City, Maryland. Their new book is 78 Acts of Liberation, and we're going to talk about that today. Lane Smith, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to talk with you.
I'm excited to talk with you. I love the book and I can't wait to dig into that. But our first question for everybody, especially I think it'll be interesting. I think your answer will be interesting. Like in this kind of era of like such visual oriented media, and that's true, I think, in protest stuff as well and organizing. Why still write books?
Well, to me, the question why write and why write books might be different answers. But I mean, to me, why write is I can't imagine not. I mean, why breathe? I can't not do it. That's why. Yeah. I can't. I have to find out what I think. I have to do it. I have to do it to survive, basically. And then the question of why write books. I mean, to be really honest with you, I am grappling with that question because it feels I have at war in me, like this crazy wild optimism and this like deep doom. And just the doom part says why even imagine that there will be future generations to read books? The oceans are burning. Why be focused on leaving something for later? There's no later. And then the wild optimistic part of me is like, we have to live as though there is a future. And like, there isn't hope unless we practice it. And we have to live as though we're going to live. And that's why. the larger scale of me writing to find out what I think, when it's published on a larger scale, then we all get to find out what we think, right? It's like, yeah. I didn't discover that I'm transgender until I heard transgender people's stories that I did not hear growing up in the early 80s, the late 70s and early 80s as a Gen X person. Like, I didn't hear those stories until now. And so I didn't hear, what we collectively think and feel and experience about gender. And so that's why I think why share writing, right? Why write to share, which publishing does, and publishing isn't the only way to do that, but why share more, why write more than just for myself, like in my diary, is because then we all get to find out what we think and feel and experience.
That resonates with me, especially the like the fight between doom and optimism. Like, I feel like I walk that line a lot too with everything. So no, I get that. So why this book then, I guess? Why 78 Acts of Liberation?
Great question. I didn't intend to write it. I would not have chosen to write it. I wouldn't have chosen for my first book to be a tarot book. But the fact of the matter is, people have told me that I will be a published writer someday since I was in like second grade. And it always felt like this inevitability, which was very demotivating for me. You know, I never tried to be published. I have in me a real like sort of rebellious kind of, I would describe it now in like newer language as demand avoidance. But like the more that someone expects something from me, the more that I'm not going to do it. in general. And so people being like, oh, you're going to be a writer. And I'm like, I do want to be a writer. And I think you're right that I will be published someday. But the more there's like this expectation that it's going to happen, I just sort of resist actually doing it. And I think it really took, I'm not very motivated by like bringing attention onto myself. Like I have all my personal planets in the 12th house. I'm a very like behind the scenes kind of person. And it just never has been motivating to me to be like, people need to know about me. And, you know, I've just never been motivated by that. So, you know, all in my 20s when I had like endless time to like write whatever I want or like plenty of free time, or like, you know, being in college and like I could be in the library or I could be in my dorm room or I could be on the lawn or whatever, mm-hmm. writing. For an infinite amount of time, like I have all this freedom to do whatever, I would just sit there and stare at the page, you know, and not feel like I have, it's not that I didn't have ideas, but I was not very motivated to produce something. And I never felt that motivation to produce something. Like I always had ideas and I would write down brainstorm ideas, but I never got past the brainstorming stage until, you know, 2021, I joined Instagram and I was seeing lots of other people's voices that I wanted to elevate and preserve because I just felt like it was going to get lost in social media. And I was like, I want to uplift and preserve voices like Maria Menounos, who wrote the foreword to my book. You know, at that time, 2021, she was doing her anti-racism with the tarot blog. And I was like, this needs to be saved, you know? And so I created the Tarot and Politics zine to promote other people and to, you know, lesser known voices in the tarot world. And I put a lot of energy into that. And that was very motivating for me because it wasn't about me. And I populated the Instagram page that I made for the zine with my own stuff, just kind of playing just for fun. It's like writing. Yes, is very easy for me. Very, like I said, it's like breathing. I can't not do it. I will just, you know, pop off whatever comes to mind just to like fill up the space to get attention on this so that people will know about the zine and know about these other voices, which were really my focus to get them uplifted. And paid. It was a pay. I wanted it to be a paid opportunity. I was like, we need to value not the same few tarot bigwigs, you know?
Yeah.
People who are talking about social issues. So that, I mean, it became, people really liked my posts and there was a lot of demand of like, you should make this into a book. You should make this into a book. And very quickly, I think within like a month, an agent had reached out to me to be like, let's make this a book. And it just, it felt beyond me. It felt like it had nothing to do with me almost. It just felt like it was going to happen regardless of me in a way. And it was just like, well, you know, I wouldn't have chosen this as my first book, but let me just look. I cut and pasted all the captions that I had written on Instagram posts and I had written 50,000 words, like doing all the cards. And I was like, well, it's practically done. Like, why say no to something that I've pretty much already done? Like, why not? People want it. Why not? It felt very much like just in service to something else, not something that was about me and my goals and what I wanted to. So that, I mean, I have just found that that is very motivating for me when it's not about me.
That makes sense to me too. I think there is, it's so funny to me. It's like writers, not all writers. I mean, I know some very extroverted writers, but you know, writers, I guess, almost stereotypically have this idea of being kind of introverted people who like to spend a lot of time alone because you're writing. Yeah. Usually you're not, that's not usually a partnered activity or a group activity. Right. Mm-hmm. And, but at the same time, like once you step over that line and decide to publish, you become a public person on some level, whether you want it or not. I mean, yeah. Yes, you can be J.D. Salinger and, you know, Pete Herman or whatever.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
The publishing industry has changed so much that it's like, it's more personalities who get published than,
right,
like you get published and become this personality. It's really changed. And I would have loved to have lived in the time where you could be a complete recluse and no one might even have ever seen your face. And you still
just
read their
put
books.
Put your books out into the world and... And some person at, you know, random house vlogs
like, they don't give interviews. Like, yeah, that's not a possibility anymore.
What would that be like? And social media to some extent has made us all public people in a weird way. And I think that that's part of it too. And it's just weird to navigate that as a not really public person.
So, yeah, it's super weird.
As the woman who has a podcast, you know, like whatever. But So I guess one of the things that I thought was really interesting about reading the book and really made me think about some bigger issues that I've kind of been wrestling with in like the witchcraft occult space. And you bring this up in the introduction to the book is that, you know, tarot, as it's been practiced for the last few decades, is kind of this tool for self-discovery, like kind of building on Mary Kay Greer and Rachel Pollack's work about this kind of like psychic journey or whatever people want to talk about it in terms of, and how to make that a collective force for better. Because I feel like it's kind of true of witchcraft and the occult in a lot of ways is it has become like very esoteric self-care in a way, and how to make that bigger. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? Like I guess how that started for you and the thought process of that.
Yeah, I remember when I was first getting into witchcraft and exploring that in 2018, I remember reading an article. I'm not sure I could find it again, but basically they were talking about how just sort of the dissonance between like organized religion, which like has all the bad things that we associate with organized religion, but also organized religion typically like mobilizes resources to like help poor people or like, you know, mobilize resources into community and helping that which is typically don't. For the most part, I mean, like solitary witchcraft is so encouraged and just be like, oh, just do it alone on your own, make it your own, make it really personal. And, it just, the way that witchcraft has become popular in such a like capitalist commodified environment has really encouraged that hyper individualist aspect to it. And it's just like, yeah, what is the point of this form of spirituality if it doesn't put resources into helping or doesn't even necessarily create community? I mean, a lot of us feel like there's a spiritual occult community online, but there's like a fine line between like community and like what's a real community and what's just sort of like a shared interest where it's also partly competitive. You know, it's like a marketplace really on Instagram, especially. And that really struck me. It's just like the lacking of community and service in much of witchcraft. And it was like, God, if we could harness, you know, the spiritual aspect of witchcraft to be more community oriented and to actually put material resources, not just thoughts and prayers and spells, you know, into service work the way that a lot of organized religions typically have. And also, you know, movement activist work, like, you know, churches were integral to the civil rights movement. That would be powerful. And certainly there are witches who do that, who have more of a collective perspective and who tried to do, like, I saw, like, Missing Witches certainly does things like that. The Witches Confluence, like, there are definitely people who try to, like, be more collectively oriented, which is awesome. But the marketing of, like, witch stuff and witch books and witch practices is so, like, hyper individualist and is, like, you know, this spicy psychology kind of, like, framework of just like
yeah,
manifest your personal whims. And so, yeah, I talked about this somewhat. I spoke at Salem Witch Fest this past spring, and that's a recorded talk that people can download from their shop if they're interested in it. But yeah, I talked about some of that, about some of the problems of how deeply psychology has crept into magic and has almost, like, taken over.
Yeah.
And so that was something hyper-individualism and relying so heavily on psychology specifically, because there's all sorts of white supremacist and social control motivations behind psychology as a whole field.
Mm-hmm.
That if we're just sort of taking for granted that psychology is this neutral good, then we're allowing that to keep seeping into what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my train of thought a little bit, but, like, yeah, I was talking about that at Salem Witch Fest, and that is something that I addressed, and that's with this book, like, specifically targeting hyper-individualism was something that was important to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for folks who haven't gotten to see or read the book yet, it will have been out for a little bit by the time this airs. But how did you approach how you wanted to organize the book? And you want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. My first seeds towards creating the book, I guess you would say, were some, like, thoughts that I had during lockdown over 2020 of just, like, what if I made a deck where each of the cards was a collective instead of an individual? And mm-hmm. I had just sort of brainstormed some things there and set it aside because I didn't really want to make a deck. But it was just a brainstorming exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, for example, I had thought of the Empress. I was like, if I was going to really detach femininity, reproduction, all of the things that typically are put, like, motherhood, all the things that are typically put on the Empress, and really, like, sharply counter that, but still keep the essence of what the Empress means,
mm-hmm.
or what it means to me, like, nurturing and creativity and that kind of thing. What would that be? And the Black Panther's free breakfast program is what immediately came to mind for me, because I was like, this is most visibly men, you know, Black men feeding children, you know, and it just, I thought a lot about how when you care enough about a problem, you get creative, and creativity doesn't always have to be giving birth or birthing a personal work of art. It can be, you know, creating something in community that mm-hmm. never existed before. I mean, their creation was so important that the the U.S. government completely sabotaged it and then copied it. Right. Like, that. Yeah. Now most kids have free breakfast. Anyway, so it started with a lot of brainstorming around what would this look like if it expanded out to be more than mm-hmm. just individual. And then as I was doing the posts on Instagram, I kind of just, I don't remember why, but I grouped them together by, like, number. I was like, well, here, I'll do the Empress first, because that's one that I had thought of. And then I was like, well, let me think through, like, how the Empress relates to other threes. Like, while we're talking about creativity and three, mm-hmm. you know, let's yeah. talk about the other threes. And so I just kept going. And it was just a way of sort of staying on theme, or just, like, mm-hmm. keeping things thematically relevant as I was going. Because I didn't have a whole plan. Like, I hadn't planned out everything that I was going to write. I was just like, well, let's just tackle this theme right now. And I really liked that way of looking at it, of looking at the the numerical groupings, and I hadn't really seen very many tarot books organized that way. And it really helps me understand better for readings, just be like, these are the themes. These are the just like 9 or 10 themes to have to worry about, instead of memorizing like special keywords for 78 different cards. It's a lot easier to learn, I think, just having like 9 or 10 yeah. themes. I say 9 or 10 because 10 reduces down to 1. So 1 and 10 are kind of related, and I put them together and separately, you know.
Yeah. No, I appreciated that aspect of it too. And I think one of the things that I really took away, and I mean, I kind of had to like speed read the book because it's just kind of how it is when I'm interviewing a bunch of people. So I can't wait to go back and really work with that idea with readings. But I love that it's really more focused on kind of the numbers and the planets and zodiac. Why can I not say the zodiac signs of the cards? Because you bring this up because you bring up Ezra, and I can't think of their last name, but the book about the appropriation of Jewish magic, basically.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And like how all this Kabbalistic stuff is also tied to the tarot and had, you know, kind of been mashed into that by, you know, Golden Dawn and practitioners along the way. And then along the way also like, well, maybe that was wrong. You know, like the history of the tarot at the beginning, I think, is really important. And if I'm going to say this, if people aren't even interested in working with the tarot, I would say get the book from your library and just read the history part.
Yeah. Because I feel the same.
Important.
I feel that way too. I feel like the history chapter is the most important part of the book too. And like, when I said that I haven't seen people organize cards numerically before, I mean, of course, Mary Kay Greer does. And that's where that comes from. And I just want to say for her, she made it very much about the numerology is personal to you. So the numerology of the cards matters in relation to the numerology of like your own birthday and things like that. And I just was sort of inspired by that to be like, yeah, let's look at the numbers, but let's see how they inform each other rather than like necessarily having to have it be a direct personal one-on-one kind of thing. Naming all those lineages and people who have been part of making tarot what it is and what it can be, and people who before me have had a liberatory lens on tarot, and telling the truth about much longer tarot history. As you said, the tarot history chapter is probably the part that I'm most proud of, because I really have not seen that. I've not seen anything really other than a Eurocentric view of how tarot came to be. And really taking apart the appropriation of Jewish mysticism, the sidelining and marginalization and punishment of Romani people, the like leaving out anything to do with Arab roots of divination systems, which is like everything that's astrology and divination can be traced back to Swana Arab communities, but our Western, quote unquote, Western society hates Arab people so much that learn that stuff. And I really feel, I think one of your questions that you had sent me in advance was like an obstacle to research. I really felt like I could have found out so much more if I knew Arabic. I only speak English, and I felt really limited by the fact that I'm only an English speaker, because I felt like there are whole histories and perspectives that I'm absolutely barred from. Like, never mind even just the algorithms now. Never mind that Google search is practically useless now because it's all like corporate sponsored search results and it's just shit. I can't even find things I used to be able to find. I can't even find things that I had searched and found at the beginning of writing the book anymore. It's garbage. And like, so that's a limitation. But even like barring all that, like just the fact that there's so much I can't access not knowing another language. But I did the best that I could, and I did a lot of research and really deep digging to get some of this stuff, to put together the pieces of why we can't just say tarot was invented by rich Italian noblemen. Yeah. You know, like, that's not the whole picture by a long shot.
No, and I think it's one of those things that, like, any contemporary practitioner of almost any strain that has to do with quote Western esotericism, it's like so much of it is appropriated or just outright thieved with the backhand of also then denigrating the people that it came from.
Absolutely.
And I think it's something that we kind of all have to wrestle with. And like, how do you build community with the originators of these ideas or accept that some of them aren't for you even, which I think some people have a harder time with. So it's such a thing to wrestle with and, you know, talk about that doom and hope thing. Like I get kind of doomy about that sometimes, like it maybe just walk away. Maybe this is not redeemable, but I think it, there's so much potential for liberation in ideas that come out of this, but we just have to accept the baggage of the history and work through that and make amends, I think, even where we can.
Yeah. And I think not having to have white European descended people be the center, not be like, right. Oh, well, it's about my personal unlearning journey. Or, you know, I could just uplift Romani practitioners now, like it's not like they're gone. And that's right. That's the whole thing, is like a lot of this white fantasy that like, oh, we did a bad thing and now those people are gone. Right. And like, is we're in this horrible moment of where that's trying to be made true of Palestinians, and people are just in this hyper awareness of like, they're not gone. And neither are indigenous, you know, people indigenous to the Americas. They're not gone either, but people treat them as if they are in the past.
About, past tense. Yeah.
Past tense, right? Land acknowledgments even are just like, well, this used to be their land, but now I'm here. You know, it's just like, they're not gone. Yeah. They're not gone. Palestinians are not gone. And it's this moment that we're in of reckoning with the violence of settler colonialism. It's like the goal is for them to be gone so we can be oh so sorry and make our acknowledgments and do our unlearning and land acknowledgments and all of that after the fact and get all their stuff, you know, their land and their stuff and their practices and their culture and, you know, and have it both ways and be like, yeah, we didn't stop the violence and we're going to be so sorry and have land acknowledgements and be so repentant or whatever later. And that's bullshit. Yeah. That's bullshit. We have to stop it.
No, people, I think that is one of the things is like, yes, the history of, again, quote unquote, Western esotericism is based on all this kind of just appropriation and outright thievery and whatever. But that doesn't mean that those people that you stole from are still like standing right there. Like,
right. Like, and what are you doing about the fact that they're not the ones invited to conferences? They're not the ones that are seen as the most renowned practitioners to go to learn from and not getting all the money. And they're not the ones getting publishing deals. Exactly. Right. That's right. Yeah. It's just like, well, you can be like, oh, I'm so sorry. But now it's all about me. Or you can be like, look, this is what's true. These people are still here. This is what you can do to support them. And that's why it was important to me. I feel a contradiction in like, I'm a white person who's publishing a book, right? Talking about this, but I really tried to make it clear that I'm just not talking about my enlightened progressive view of cards. I'm talking about the whole context of tarot. I'm talking about how Black women tarot reviewers get treated when they have criticisms of a white creator's deck. And I'm talking about like the publishing industry. And I'm talking about the fact that Romani people live in poverty because they were punished for fortune telling, and white people now are like, oh, I'm not a fortune teller. You know, it's all related and connected.
Or I am
and
a fortune a teller, and here's my
context, right?
Romani slur business name.
Yes, exactly. Right. Like that's I feel like my strength as a quadruple Sagittarius is to take the way zoomed out view, which isn't always the most important view. I mean, like, you know, when we look at what's happening in Palestine right now, the satellite images of Gaza that show, you know, lights out, you know, is an important perspective. And it doesn't touch people in the same way as personal stories or like the things happening to individuals, right. But it is a perspective that contributes to the whole. And I feel like my perspective is more of that, like zoomed out satellite, just to give like the whole entire context, but I really leave it to, you know, the Roma practitioners, the Black practitioners, the people who have been marginalized that I am trying to show everybody, in context with the history matter, I leave it to them to hopefully, you know, bring that intimate view, and that's even more important.
I think one of the things that you do so well in the introduction and throughout the book is when you're talking about ideas that have originated with, you know, either specific contemporary people or with cultures from various time points, it's not just a, oh, like, here's my footnote citation. It's like you name them, you talk about how they came to that. Like, it's not just, oh, I'm just making sure you know I know where this came from. It's really integrating their ideas into your ideas that then you present and say, hey, by the way, this wasn't me. This came from here. And I think is not something that always happens in modern occult books.
I will say that is definitely something that I have learned from Black feminists specifically. I think Black feminists especially are always like, name your lineage, name, you know, where this came from. And I, you know, that's a practice that I think is correct. You know, it's like, you know, everything is contextual and nothing is a footnote.
Right.
Like, Yeah, it's important to me to name all that, not just like buried in the back in the acknowledgments and not in a footnote, but it's a way of saying I'm not the focus. It's not about me. I'm part of it. I'm not going to say I'm nothing, I'm nobody, and I don't have good ideas. I do, but I don't have to be above everything else be an important part of the fabric.
Well, and to me, like, that is part of building community, right? Is that you're part of the whole, not in charge of it, not 100% responsible for it. Not, you know, like, it's really to have a community, all pieces have to be part of that discussion and work of being a community in equitable way. So,
it takes practice. Totally makes sense to me. I'm 45 years old. I've done it wrong and fucked up a lot. You know, and I, you know, the thing is to keep going and not be like, oh, well, I'm embarrassed, or, oh, you know, that didn't land well. And so I'm just going to take my ball and go home or whatever. Like, I don't know. I probably, being a quadruple Sagittarius, I'm more willing to fuck up and just be like, you know,
I mean, I think that was a lesson for me. Like, I had people who cared enough about me to call me out and call me in early on. And I will 100% cop to not taking it well the first couple times and really having to figure out why, like, have to sit with why I was so resistant to that. And, you know, it's one, you know, I think people get caught up on this idea of white guilt and white. And I'm like, you know, it's not a helpful thought, really. I mean, it doesn't progress you in any way. It's like, you can sit there and wallow in it all day, but it doesn't change anything, except you get to feel a victim of your own, you know, culture or whatever. And so I think that willingness to learn and to fuck up and to be part of that is also community. That's what community is.
Right. Right.
You know, is that, you know, yes, you screw up and someone will say, hey, you screwed up. And then you'll be like, okay, I will not do that again. I'm going to sit with why I did it. And thank you for taking the time. And I've said this before in the podcast that if someone takes the time to call you out or call you in, that's an act of love. If they didn't give a shit about you, they would just walk away.
Right. And if you don't have any of those relationships where people feel safe to tell you that you fucked up, you have even bigger problems. Like, it's not that you're doing everything right. It's if you're not someone that people can say you fucked up to, that is worse. That's worse. To never hear that you fucked up is much worse.
Yeah. And I think that there is this idea that if you screw up, that paralyzes you and people freeze in that moment. Like you said, take your ball and go home, or you should just appreciate that I'm here, or that I'm trying to be an ally or whatever. And I'm like, it's such a hard lesson that I think we all have to learn again and again, is that, you know, if you make the commitment to be in community, you work through those things. You figure out how to go forward and not make it about you, not make it about even make it about your mistake. You just have to move forward from that. And it's just hard. And I think we will all continue to screw up and learn and get better. And that is progress in the way that we can have it.
Yeah. And you're never going to do that alone. Like you can't do it outside of community. You can't be like, well, I'll just like not be around anybody different from me or whatever until I've perfected myself and can present myself flawlessly to the world. That is not reality.
Yeah.
And you won't. Yeah, it's not possible to perfect yourself, period. Yeah.
But and
it's
definitely not with possible it to on do the it left. Alone. I mean,
yeah.
I hate the truism that, you know, there's no one who hates each other more than two leftists who agree on 95% of what they're talking about. And I'm just like, I hate that we're like that. And it's like, you know, one of the things I do think about a lot, and you brought this up in the book too, is about let's figure out our points of unity and work from there. And we have to figure that out. Like, there's no other way to move forward at this point. We can't just keep being crabs in a bucket.
Totally. I am a big left unity person. It's why I don't say I'm a socialist or I'm a communist or I'm an anarchist. I did identify as a socialist and communist for a long, 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 long time when I was a card-carrying member of one of those organizations, and I could not be now. And I am more sympathetic to anarchist points of view than I ever have been before, but I'm more at a point now where I'm like, I find labels are not as useful, whether that's gender or the particular faction of leftism that you're doing or whatever. I just am like, can we be fluid? Can we be gender fluid? Can we be, liberation fluid? I don't know. Like, obviously I want everybody to be like on the left. I don't mean fluid between like left or right, look, go left or right, but like within the field of people who are on the side of liberation, can we be a little more fluid than being like, you must choose, are you a communist or an anarchist? And here's all the like points of argument, the tenets that you have to subscribe to and the reading that you have to have done and blah, 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 blah. When shit hits the fan, it's going to be communists and anarchists at the barricades. And, you know, it's we're going to be doing what we have to do to survive. Yeah. So why waste all this energy? I don't know. Well, I guess it's not wasted energy, but it's.
I don't think it's energy that moves us forward, I guess.
It's like those are arguments that can happen when they're relevant. And it's just like there are more pressing things right now.
It's funny you said that about, you know, when the shit hits the fan, and I think a lot about the fact that, you know, it's so easy contemporarily to not realize that like your first responder is going to be your neighbor.
Yeah.
Even if they're flying a flag you might not agree with.
Yep. Yes.
And how
do
you
just had a conversation on another like, podcast how do you, about this? Yes.
How do you navigate that? And like, I live in a very diverse neighborhood in San Jose, and you know, we have met all our neighbors, and I know that we don't agree on everything, But we agree to be good neighbors with each other.
Yes.
Because we live here in houses that you can reach out and touch, you know, like you've got to be that way. And I think it's so hard to do that when all of the programming we get from social media and even mainstream media is how divided we are. Mm-hmm. And like we are in this bigger sense. But when you're talking about the person who's going to come over and make sure that you've got water.
Yeah.
That might not be a person you agree with about everything.
No, absolutely true. I'm so with you. Yeah. Local connections are so. People really want to focus on like who closest fits my exact personality and worldview or whatever on the internet. But yeah, when shit hits the fan, and I keep saying that, but like the shit has hit the fan. Yeah. It's just like, you know, to different people to different degrees, but the fan is spreading shit as we speak. Yes. But yes. Yeah, like, so, you know, I live in a majority Black city. My daughter is the only white girl in her class. My youngest child is the only white child in the daycare. Like, I have a big old pride flag outside of my house on my block, and I walk around, you know, looking like a trans mask person. And I know other people on my block are not people that I would have connected with on social media for sure. Mm-hmm. They've got military veteran stuff on their lawn or whatever, mm-hmm. or they've got, you know, not Biden or Trump Jesus. And yes. I'm like, you know what? I don't like. I'm with you on the not Biden or Trump part. And I don't, you know, I'm like, maybe we're closer than I would think, having this red, white, and blue flag that's like not Biden or Trump Jesus. I think they're coming at that from a conservative angle, but like, for real, the fact of the matter is every one of my neighbors is kind to me, even though we clearly, obviously have ideological and quote unquote lifestyle differences.
Right.
They still invite me to their house in the backyard to have food. They still would, you know, there was a day that the school was evacuated and I didn't get the message. And someone knocked on my door and was like, don't you have a child at this elementary school? They're evacuated to the church. Like, you know, they're not going to be like, oh, they'll figure it out. They like, we watch out for each other in a very real way. And I can't imagine not living like that at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think about my neighbor, like they are neighbors without giving too much away. Like it's a multi-generational situation that lives next door to us too. Our house is also multi-generational, and they leave their front door open all the time. I think because they don't have air conditioning, which is not great in San Jose, but I think their front door is open all the time. And so like we first moved in, we had a couple like porch pirate incidents, like when we had ordered like cat food, you know, like stuff like that. And he was like, oh, you know, I'll keep an eye out. And they do, you know, and it's just like, it's just those tiny things that you're like, it doesn't matter if they have total, like you said, ideological lifestyle choices are different than ours. We're neighbors. A neighbor, right. The word neighbor has a meaning to it.
Yeah,
and an importance should. To it.
And I feel like in a lot of predominantly white communities, it doesn't. They might not know their neighbor's name or anything about them at all. And they feel like that's normal.
Before we moved into this house, we lived in an apartment more in the center of Silicon Valley. And the entire 2 years that we lived there, I never even saw the person who lived across from us. I never even saw them, let alone knew who they were or anything about them. And it was just weird to me. Like, it just felt like the most isolating experience to live in this giant apartment complex and not know anyone.
Yeah. And I feel like white culture encourages that kind of like isolation. And then, like, at the same time, whiteness is this death cult of, like, certainty that you will not be held by community. So if you become useless in any way, then you might as well just die.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, if it's like, if I had to, like, struggle or turn to someone else or become dependent. I've just been thinking about this so much lately, this contradiction of where, like, the ultra rich would rather die than not be dependent on others doing work for them. It's like the idea of like work or struggle or any discomfort whatsoever is like, they'd rather die. And so all of us are on this death drive because they're like, well, we're going to go out while we're on top. We're just going to fuck up the planet and everything and just die while we're comfortable. But so the rich white people are like, I'd rather die than not be dependent on mm-hmm. others' labor. And then, but this ideology of like self-sufficiency among white working people and white poor people is like, it's like literally, I'd rather die than ever be dependent on anyone else.
Yeah. And I mean, that again, like humans are made for that. That's like how our cultures right. and societies evolved, is to be interdependent.
Right, right. And it's so sad. I mean, I grew up even like, yeah, rich people like disconnecting because they want to like live high on the hog or whatever is one thing. But like, I grew up in a poor family in a rural area. Like my dad was from a farming family. It's not like they didn't know work or struggle, but everybody constantly was always like, oh, if I ever get sick or disabled or anything, if I lose my ability to XYZ, just put me out of my misery. I don't want to be a burden on anybody. I don't want to be alive. Yeah. Like people talked about suicide very casually all the time to be like, if I lose my usefulness, I would rather die than be a burden on my family yeah. or be dependent in any way. If I lose my ability to be completely independent, I might as well be dead. Was like a casual thing that people would say
yeah.
all Which the time. So and my grandmother so did in fact attempt suicide when they took away her driver's license. It's like, if I can't drive, I'd just rather be dead. Wow. And that is so wild, right? And like yeah. certainly like that has affected me. It's a deep, horrific ableism to be like, you must be self-sufficient and can't lean on anybody ever or you should be dead.
Mm-hmm. It also seems the thing about it that I find so confusing is a lot of that also comes out of communities that also profess to be deeply Christian.
Mm.
And that seems antithetical to what, you know, I mean, I will say I was not the best Bible study person as a kid, even though I went to Christian churches, but that's not how what I took away from that experience at all.
Yeah, I don't have a very religious background, so I can't really speak to that, but I when I look at Christians, I think of like having a community orientation, but of course I'm mostly surrounded by Black churches, but even just like the gay, like Unitarian Universalist. I mean, I think of that as being a way of being in community more mm-hmm. than anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a funny, I think we're just in this very weird place between navigating like personal survival and how do we make sure everybody else survives too. And I think it's, you know, sometimes it's just hard and you're just like head down trying to do what you need to do to be here and kind of. And then sometimes you look up and you're like, oh, crap, we're all in the same boat. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel that. I mean, you know, I'm a single parent and it's like, OK, if I need a break, do I ask other people who already have kids and are already exhausted and overburdened mm-hmm. like I am? Because it feels hard to ask someone else who's going through the same thing and is already overtaxed the way that I feel. Or do I ask someone who's child free, who they're like, my life is full, I don't have time for that, or I chose not to have kids so I wouldn't have to do that. See ya. You know, like they're not going to do it.
Yeah.
And so just this culture where people don't see children as everybody's responsibility, where the focus even on the left has been around personal choice.
Mm-hmm.
It fucking sucks to have it thrown in your face. They're like, well, that's what you chose. That's not what I chose. So you're alone.
Yeah. And we have destroyed all of our villages.
It's shitty. It's shitty.
Yeah. But I guess kind of to pull back to the book and writing, like I feel no, it is a constant on this podcast. So anyone listening will be like, oh yeah, that was the rabbit hole for today. But I think one of the things that I took away from this book, and I think I hope that other people who pick it up and I'm kind of curious what you hope people take away from it, is that no matter how deeply you've dug yourself into a hole of like, this is your choice, this is what I'm doing for me, there is a way out. And sometimes it can be in places where you didn't expect it, like tarot. And so I hope that people take that away from it. What is your hope for the takeaway from this book?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the book was born of a frustration of people using tarot for sort of like navel gazing, for like just exclusively reflection, or where like, what do I do? Like, I feel like the most common question of tarot is, what do I do? And it seems like what people take from what tarot says is like, reflect on this more, right? Or like, think differently, or what, like, it's so internal work that people take from what tarot says. And I'm like, what if you could trust that tarot could tell you to do something actually really concrete? So I know this episode isn't out until September, and it's June right now, and I'm doing this for Pride Month challenge on my Instagram page. That's a No Pride and Genocide Tarot Challenge, where instead of like a daily card pull, I'm doing a weekly two card pull, where one is a reflection to a specific question that I a prompt that I put, and then an action, a pulling a card for an action. Mm-hmm. And then the third post is supposed to be accountability of like, did you do it? Because I feel like we see endless on social media, endless tarot readings of like, this reading helped me understand XYZ. But I don't know if you ever applied it. I don't know what you did as a result of that tarot reading. And mm-hmm. we think of readers as being people who have smart things to say about cards or ask really great questions. But I want to know what people are actually doing with what mm-hmm. tarot tells them. And it's like, to me, like making it really concrete matters. And so like this first week, you know, I pulled a card for the action for this week, and it was the Empress. And I was talking about like doing something creative, doing something with my kids or whatever. And I'm actually like, to me, the action that it inspired for me was to do like this, to make these stickers and put them up like in the gay neighborhoods, like highlighting how Palestine is relevant for queer community. And like, that is a specific action, and I'm going to do it. Right. And it's like, it's not like, oh, reflect more on like creativity in my life or whatever. It's like, make some stickers and put them up. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that's the action. And so like, that's what I want most of all, is for people to realize you can use tarot for more than just sort of like shifting your ideas and consciousness and like personal development or whatever. You can actually do things and like, let yourself be guided on what to do. And so to me, the book is really about action and bridging that gap between understanding and doing.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I think that is a great segue into, because you already talked about kind of what you're up to just mm-hmm. kind of let people know where to find the book, when it's out, where to find more about your work. Yeah. And anything you have coming up that'll be like last half of September into the end of the year.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the book is wherever you buy books. It's a traditionally published book. Sounds True is the publisher. So you can buy it from Sounds True. You can buy it wherever you buy books. You know, of course, like independent booksellers, I would encourage that. But where, like wherever you buy books, you can order it. It's the publication date is August 20th. So it will already have been out when this airs. And I'm on Instagram. The handle is at Left Lane Smith. And my website is mxlanesmith.com. What I have going on? Yeah, I have the Pride Challenge right now. I have a little ebook that I wrote that I'm doing as a fundraiser for families in Gaza. I don't know if that will still be relevant in September. I kind of hope that it won't. I hope that you know, things will be better by then, but I don't know. But so it's the ebook is called Tarot Together, and it's just sort of some activities to use tarot with groups of three or more. Like it's mm-hmm. just to break that binary of like the reader querent thing. It's just a little like ebook, short ebook to like help play with that. And it's a pay what you want. And all the proceeds from that go to a family in Gaza. And that's pretty much what I have going on. Yeah, I'm a very sort of like get inspired and act on the moment. I don't plan way far ahead. I mean, I do have back burner projects in my mind for maybe a second book, but I'm not really ready to talk about that.
Yeah, so. No, that totally makes sense. Well, cool. Well, thank you for that. And I'll put links to all that in the show notes.
Yeah, thanks.
And so our last question, I want listeners to know that I did talk to Lane about this and did not just spring it on them. We're going to do our last question a little different today. So I am still going to roll the die. And depending on what number I get, we'll talk about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll six, Lane gets to pick what they want. And then instead of asking a question, I'm going to pick a tarot card. And we'll talk about it kind of in context of that subject and in context of Lane's work with the tarot. So we'll see how this goes. It could be chaos, but yeah. We're recording chaos in Gemini season. So we're going to embrace the chaos.
Exactly. Chaos.
Yeah, we're embracing Gemini season chaos.
Uh-huh. Love it.
So two, sex.
How did I know it was going
to
be sex?
I think I may have to change up my die. Like I keep getting twos. Not that I mind, but I just find it amusing. Okay, let's see. I am using a Rider Waite Smith knockoff. That is the tea-stained tarot for anyone who's interested. Because though I like Pamela Coleman Smith's artwork, I don't like the colors. So this one is just black and white on like parchment color. So let's figure a card. Oh, the Five of Pentacles.
Hmm.
That's an interesting card to talk about in context of sex.
Yeah. It's interesting for me personally because that was my card of the month that I drew for May. Mm-hmm. And May is always like sexy times for me. The full moon in Scorpio really has a sexually charged energy to me. And I was really bummed out to draw the Five of Pentacles for May because that is always such a juicy, sensual time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. Because specifically, like when I pull cards for the year ahead, I pull for each month, I pull a say yes, embrace, you know, move towards this one card and then a no, avoid, stay away from this, say no to this.
I like that approach. That's nice.
Other cards. So the say yes card, the embrace card was the Five of Pentacles. And I was like, that fucking sucks. What do you mean? embrace that. Because I think that is bringing kind of hard energy. I had to sort of like tone down just how hard like I perceive that card to be. Yeah. Like could it just be getting uncomfortable? It doesn't have to be like this deep, heavy hardship. And I had listened to an embodied astrology podcast talking specifically from my rising sign, which is Capricorn, talking about like, you know what, a lot of what you think might be like easeful is really just habit, or it's just what you've been accustomed to. And it actually might be really painful. You're just used to it. And so to actually feel pleasure, you have to get uncomfortable and you have to do things that feel awkward or even not good to get to the pleasure part. And that spoke to me and was useful for me as far as like getting out of my usual comfortable self-isolating routine to like put myself. I did a queer speed dating thing, which just sounded like the most horrific thing imaginable to me. Like I was just like, oh my God, I can't imagine anything I'd rather not do. So I did that. and that was cool. It was draining in a way to be like meeting so many people that fast for me. That's a lot, but it was good to get out and flirt and just do things I haven't done in so long. And so I think, you know, it's useful to me to remember that struggle, discomfort and struggle can be awesome. That pleasure pain thing of like Scorpio Taurus axis pleasure pain stuff can be really sexy.
Well, I always think too, like, you know, our growth edges, like that's like growth pains, and just that, like, sometimes it's uncomfortable or painful to grow in those things. And like you said, to find pleasure, sometimes you do have to step out of the, like, what a relief when you've gotten used to walking with a stone in your shoe to take it out. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think there's things that, like, I love that idea of things that we think are easy might just be routine.
And, or pain that we're used to.
Yeah. I mean, wow. That's something to sit with. So.
Awesome. Yeah. And the imagery of that card too is like pain that you're used to is like you'll walk right past any new opportunity because you're just so like, this is what I'm used to. This is what I'm used to.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Lane, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for just like being open and vulnerable and open for crazy Gemini energy.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
I pick up the book, y'all. Just trust me. Pick up the book. I can't wait to just like spend more time with it and really.
Oh, thank you so much.
Work through my deck and talk about that with other folks. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.